You are listening to the Everything You Want to Know About Therapy, But We're Too Afraid to Ask podcast with your host, Jennifer Trevelli, and co-host, Jessica Strang. If you ever wanted to start therapy but didn't know where to begin, you've come to the right place. In this podcast, we will offer a Therapy 101 by interviewing experts in the field and asking them anything and everything you wanted to know about therapy before you make your first appointment. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Jamie Passas. Dr. Passas is a psychiatrist who specializes in child and adolescent clients. She's been working in the field of psychiatry for more than 20 years, and we're so happy to have her on the podcast. Podcast, and thank you for being here with us. You have been in the field for over 20 years now, but before that, what initially made you decide to study psychiatry?
Hi, ladies. Well, thank you for having me. I got into psychiatry probably in college. So my undergrad, I actually started off my first year in nursing. And then I think I took an abnormal psych class with Jen. And I remember learning about OCD. And Jen, I actually think you were the one that actually told me about the psychiatry field. And then I kind of read up more about it. And then I think at some point I did an internship with a child with autism, worked with their family. I remember having to go to psychiatry appointments with him. And so I was just kind of intrigued at, you know, what they did. And then during my clinical rotations in med school is kind of when I knew that I definitely did want to specialize in it.
I remember that when you worked with that, the family with the the boy with autism. I remember like hearing the stories and just the experience that you received working there, like pre-graduate school, like pre-anything really.
Yeah. And I actually, you know, the company they were with, I actually worked with that, went back to work, actually, I think in the school for autism that they had a couple years later before I actually started residency. So I kind of knew I always wanted to work specifically child psychiatry.
And so when you were in grad school, what were some of those lessons that you felt were important, or what were some of the things that you felt, other than the experience that you had working with the autistic child, what were some things that you felt kind of helped you or you learned from about psychiatry or about even wanting to do it? Because it sounds like starting in nursing, I always take that as you want to be a helper in some way, you know? And so, and then specializing in psychiatry, what were some of those lessons you learned along the way in graduate school?
So I think for me, so for grad school, I guess, which would be medical school, I kind of went a non-traditional route. I actually ended up going to a school in the Caribbean.
So that must be nice.
Yeah, it was nice. You know, when you're there though, one thing I really wish I had done first, or what I wish I did do, was enjoy being there at the moment. Because I think when you're there, you know, you are actually on the island to do more of the classroom stuff. So I think I spent a little too much time worrying, you know, like if I would make it back and, you know, passing all the exams, that I actually wish I had enjoyed the moment more, you know, being able to, you know, live on an island. But
that's amazing. I personally know that one of my regrets is that I did not come to visit you while you were in school.
I know.
What was up with that, Jen?
A place to stay on a Caribbean island.
I mean, that sounds like a dream, an absolute dream. I would have been in your suitcase.
I mean, it was like studying on the beach, you know, jumping into the ocean after like anatomy class. Yeah.
I mean, like, sign me up.
Yeah. It goes by, you know, now I realize it did go by fast. When you're there, though, it feels like, you know, you're never going to make it home, but I eventually did. And I just kind of learned, you know, just if you really want something, it just take, you know, it wasn't an easy road, but if you put in the work and the time, you definitely can, you know, kind of achieve what you want to, and you can be successful, and to also ask for help too. You know, I feel like I'm still learning, constantly learning, you know, even from my colleagues today. So
absolutely. I know one of the questions that I tend to get asked oftentimes within the field is mm-hmm. what is the difference between a psychiatrist and a psychologist? I think there's so many different aspects in behavioral health and in the mental health field, and so many different roles
yeah.
that people have. And I think I noticed the biggest confusion for a lot of people is the difference between a psychiatrist and a psychologist. Can you shed some light on that for us?
Yeah, we get that question a lot. You know, I primarily work with children right now. And a lot of times, you know, when I meet new families, they oftentimes, sometimes they actually think they're seeing a psychologist. So
really?
So I usually set the stage of, you know, what, you know, actually finding out how they got referred to me, you know, why they're seeing me, to see if they have an understanding. Because sometimes, you know, it's their primary doctor referring them. And sometimes they're unsure, I think, mm-hmm. of who to refer them to. But mm-hmm. usually, you know, one main difference is, you know, the training. To be a psychiatrist, you do have to go through medical school after your undergrad. Mm-hmm. And then you do a residency. And then depending on if you want to further specialize, you would do a fellowship, which is what I had to do to work with kids and adolescents. And then with the psychology route, which you guys probably know more of, you go through like a doctorate of psychology right after undergrad. Mm-hmm. And then the other difference too is that all psychiatrists will manage medication. Mm-hmm. Some may do therapy, but I think most is more medication management, depending on the type of setting they're in and what they want to actually do. And then I know for psychologists, I think the focus is therapy, although I know now recently there are some psychologists that may be able to prescribe medication.
I have heard that. Mm-hmm. I've heard the psychologist prescribing meds, and I personally don't feel comfortable because I don't have that medical training and right. would not even pretend to. But you know, the other thing that you just brought up was really important, was that not only do I also get that question as like, are you a psychiatrist? Are you a psychologist? But also just my psychiatrist doesn't talk to me, you know, or mm-hmm. my psychiatrist gives me my medications. So how much do you think like in your day to day, do you play a role in, and also kind of, I guess, chatting, you know, or is that, you know, because I know that, you know, back in the day, psychiatrists would have more time, maybe to talk, or maybe that was just the field. And then maybe psychologists took over and did that talk therapy piece. But what do you think about that, like when it comes to, you know, your own work?
Yeah, I think, you know, the type of setting that I'm in, I do think I'm fortunate enough that my, you know, my administration allows me to choose the amount of time I can spend with patients. And that's partly the reason that, you know, I came to work where I am now. I think, again, it really depends on the setting that you're in, where, you know, it sometimes, unfortunately, could be driven by insurance,
right?
Where you have to do 15-minute med checks, which is why you might encounter some psychiatrists that really are just very straightforward, focused side effects, you know, what issues are going on, and just talking about medications. For me, though, especially working with kids and adolescents, you know, it's, you have to incorporate, I always tell parents, you know, I don't do formal therapy, but I do incorporate, a lot of it could be more supportive therapy, but, you know, initial evaluation for me, oftentimes we're not talking about medication recommendations. We're really just trying to, I'm trying to find out like what's going on, you know, what the concerns are, how did they get to me?
Okay.
Yeah. So it really depends who you're seeing. And some psychiatrists, you know, I think in private practice may prefer to do specific types of therapy, and they're able to, you know, incorporate that in their clinics. Yeah.
What would you say that you like most about your work?
I think it probably is just being able to work, you know, with families and with patients and their families, and really getting to know them. So I see a lot of kids starting kind of in middle school, and then oftentimes will continue through their high school career. So it's a, you know, it's pretty amazing to actually watch them grow, and also watch the parents grow as well. So, and I'm always amazed, like how much, even at the first meeting, you know, I'm a stranger to them, and they, kids and parents just open up, you know, about really intimate details, and they're willing to trust you off the bat.
I think it's so interesting. I'm sorry to interrupt you, Jamie. You know, I think it's really interesting that you chose the field of being with children, adolescents. Was that just
from, you know, because, or you know, for you, I know you did your fellowship in with child and adolescent. Mm-hmm. Why, you know, I guess why choose that? You know, because you do have the chance, right, in rotation. Yeah. I mean, or did you not have the, I don't know. You know, I don't know anything about med school.
Yeah. No, for psychiatry, you do have to become certified in general psychiatry, which is mm-hmm. working with adult psychiatry. So I did do during residency, I did work with adults in the outpatient setting and the inpatient setting. And I just seemed to enjoy working with the kids more. I think mm-hmm. I felt they were, you know, just easily, I don't know, like amenable to changes mm-hmm. and to watch, you know, a little, you know, just to see them from this start, you know, for some reason it just, I enjoyed outpatient work with children mm-hmm. more than I did with adults. But, you know, what I realized working with families, you don't really get away.
Exactly.
Because it's also, yeah, working yeah. with the kids, it's really understanding to, you know, the parents, you know, mm-hmm. granted, I, you know, I'm not treating the parents, but it's also understanding, you know, their history and, you know, where they're coming from as well, especially with, you know, using medications. And obviously we get parents that, you know, are nervous, understandably, mm-hmm. to use them, but understanding like why they are and, you know, and just, you know, having a discussion about that. So you need that adult training.
Yeah. Right.
You know, to work with the kids for sure.
Right. You definitely have to take in that yeah. bigger picture when you're working with a child or an adolescent. It's not themselves in a vacuum. It's really kind of their whole right. system. Which yeah. is wonderful that yeah. you went down that road, because there's definitely not enough child and adolescent specialized psychiatrists yeah. out there.
Yeah,
absolutely.
No, there's a big need. I think, you know, I was just looking at the latest statistics, and I think as of, I want to say 2019, I believe there's about a little over 8,000 child and adolescent psychiatrists, and probably, I think 15 million, you know, kids and teens.
Unbelievable. Need.
I know, which, you know, over, that was, I think that statistic was 2019, but since then, with everything happening, that need has grown.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
absolutely.
We see that, you know, I see that where I work, there's actually only two of us that serve a big hospital system. So.
That's amazing. Yeah. And so I guess to follow up is, Why would someone come to see you? You know, so mm-hmm. you know, are the reason, like, you know, just to backtrack, the reason why Jen and I wanted to do this podcast was to kind of inform the public about everything what they want to know about therapy, and the big piece of it was to medication. So then, I guess, mm-hmm. what role would that play if somebody wants to go to therapy? Why would somebody even, you know, try to get an appointment? Because I know it's hard, mm-hmm. you know, because
yeah.
you're busy.
No,
but
it's
why
a good
would
question.
They do that? Why would they come to see you?
Yeah, so usually, you know, we get referrals from therapists, from pediatricians, you know, primary doctors, and typically it's because someone is in therapy and maybe the progress is slow, or mm-hmm. they're just not improving as fast as we would like, or the severity of their symptoms is significant, and there might be a role to add medication mm-hmm. to improve the symptoms. So we see, you know, I typically see kids from 6 to 18, you know, for various issues, low anxiety, ADHD, depression, even behaviors related to autism, you know, so a wide range of psychiatric issues. But it's typically the idea, ideally, they should be referred to us, you know, with the idea, with the question, is medication going to be, is it needed right now?
And I think that's really important because a lot of times, you know, you don't know. And so coming to see mm-hmm. you would be really important for families to be able to then discern what the next step to take. Mm-hmm. So it sounds like it's one of those right. steps to take.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, sometimes I do see a lot of people where I don't feel medication is appropriate right now. And I may encourage, or sometimes we get people that haven't even tried therapy. And so I definitely always advocate for that first, you know, if mm-hmm. given the circumstances, it's appropriate. And then maybe reassess and have them come back in, you know, 3 or 6 months to see if we still, you know, if medication is needed.
So kind of along the lines of that, what are some of the types of medications that are out there for mental health issues?
Yeah, so there are so many different medications, you know, mm-hmm. that are out there. And I always tell, you know, families, there's not one right medication that works for everybody. But, you know, even in children, adolescents, we use, like, let's say for depression, we use antidepressants. For anxiety, there's certain anxiolytics that we can use too. You know, ADHD medication, there's a whole range of medications as well to use for that. You know, I could go into more detail, but typically it's stimulants, non-stimulants. So there's different categories and different protocols and regimens that you do follow, you know, and kind of following FDA guidelines as well in determining, you know, which medication to use. But I always say there's not one right medicine for everybody.
And so I guess the follow-up question to that is, when it comes to medication, you know, mm-hmm. or when it comes to, you know, seeing you, what would somebody expect when they first come in, you know, because mm-hmm. they, yeah. you know, you're not only telling them, you know, psychiatrist versus psychologist, a lot of times you're not only, you know, talking right. about the different, you know, trying to figure out how can I be supportive? How can we discern what's the next step? But what, you know, what would it look like? So I'm patient yeah. A coming in to see you with my kiddo. What would that look like to meet you?
Yeah. So usually I let families know off the bat, you know, we're going to meet in two visits to complete the evaluation. Sometimes I can get through everything in the first evaluation. Mm-hmm. But typically I let them know the first visit is just information gathering, some demographic information, finding out even developmental history. Mm-hmm. Between the two, and I typically will meet, depending on the age, I might meet with the kids first and then I bring the parents in.
And
then between the first and the second visit, you know, there's certain, I guess, paperwork or other evaluations that I have. I might have teacher fill out.
Okay.
There's a parent form. I usually have them fill out just about symptoms. And, you know, kids, I have the same form. They can fill out as well. You know, some kids will share a lot off the bat. Some mm-hmm. are just, yes, no, I can't get too much. But on paper, sometimes things come out more. So a lot of right. that paperwork, it's just more guidelines to give me more insight mm-hmm. into what's going on or things that maybe they don't feel comfortable talking about, the, you know, at the first visit. And then, you know, it's also taking a thorough medical history as well.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I sometimes might get what I call like baseline lab work just to make sure there's no like anemia going on or thyroid issues, because sometimes things like that can also present with psychiatric issues. So you always want to check that out as well. And then, you know, if there are certain medical issues, sometimes they need to reach out to someone's, you know, cardiologist, you know, or other, you know, other physicians that they're working with. And then second visit is where we will talk about recommendations. So if it is more medication, we talk extensively about, you know, which medicines, possible side effects, you know, and usually tell parents it's, you know, they have to be comfortable to start medication. So we may not start it off the bat, and sometimes they might want to think about it more. Mm-hmm. And then we might meet again in a couple months or weeks.
So kind of going along, I know, like you had mentioned, side effects with medication. And I know if you, as we all know, if you watch any TV commercials, you'll see commercials yes. for medication. And like at the end of the commercial, they'll have like the scrolling list of all the possible side effects that could happen with this medication. Right. So could you tell us, like, you talk a little bit more about side effects? Like, why do they happen? What should people be aware of? Kind of when they see the medication they're taking on the commercial and they see this whole long list of side effects, you know, how would you kind of explain mm-hmm. that to them?
Yeah, I usually tell families, you know, all medications have side effects, even over-the-counter medications. Mm-hmm. So even Tylenol, aspirin. Typically side effects occur because, you know, the medicines are working on increasing certain neurotransmitters in our body. So certain chemicals in our body that we all have, some have less of an amount than others, nothing that we can actually test for. But these neurotransmitters also work on various receptors in the body. So that's why sometimes you might get a headache or you might get stomach issues. Hmm. But I usually, you know, what I usually say is we always, especially in kids and teens, we definitely start low and we go slow. So you may not see an immediate effect right away, but the idea of that is to minimize the risk of side effects. So I usually say we can't guarantee no side effects at all. We're trying to really find the balance of minimal side effects, but also improving their symptoms. You know, so it's just finding that balance.
And I guess a follow-up question to that is,
you know, one of the things that a lot of my clients will come in for, I'd say half and half. Half depression, mm-hmm. half anxiety. Well, I guess maybe not half and half. Maybe it's a third depression, a third anxiety, and then the other third is a mix of both. Mm-hmm. The main question I'll get probably from my clients with depression is, why does this medication take 6 to 8 weeks? And I don't know the answer. So I'm always like, and I said, I don't know. Ask your psychiatrist. Because, I know what I know, right? And so what do you think is, so let's say, for example, one of those longer, acting medications, what's going on with that?
Well, I think, I also get that question.
Okay, good.
So sometimes I say, honestly, we don't really know the why. And that's the thing with psychiatry and medicine. Well, psychiatry in general, like some people ask, why do I have depression? Why do I have anxiety? Sometimes it's not a clear cut answer. Like everything in your life could be going well, but we don't know the why to it. Even with, why it takes so long. I think part of it, though, is that certain medications just need to reach a certain dose to become effective, and it takes time. But again, we don't really exactly know why, which can be frustrating because it is in psychiatry definitely a trial and error. You have to have patience and give things time.
Mm-hmm. And you know what, actually, just to kind of sum off that, I love that answer because I think that we are in an age where we always want to know exactly certain things, mm-hmm. but there's some things like our human behavior that they're really, it's just a mix of so many different, pieces mm-hmm. that we don't always know the reason why. And so, mm-hmm. One of the things that I think is so important that you mentioned earlier was tailoring the medication to the person and kind of going low and slow, mm-hmm. Just because, mm-hmm. it may be that you need a higher dose for one person for whatever reason versus another. And I think that's, it's one of those things that I think it's important for people to know, it's.
Yeah. Everyone's unique.
Well, and I think what happens for a lot of people, and I shouldn't say for a lot of people, but I know what's happened in people that I've talked with is that they really are hoping that medication is this like quick fix, that they're going to start taking the medication and they're going to feel better. Like people tend to take like Tylenol mm-hmm. or ibuprofen, and you take it and you feel better shortly after you take it. But that's not necessarily the case with the psychotropic medications, is it?
Correct. That's correct. I usually, sometimes I encounter some patients where we've tried multiple medications. And for me, that's when I kind of take a step back to be like, okay, is it, and I always tell them it's not going to be just about medication, mm-hmm. and I think therapy is even more important, but it takes mm-hmm. work, right? So you have to keep up with it. And that also is not going to be immediate. And, that can be frustrating. I understand that for patients, it's frustrating that they want that immediate help, so you try to counsel them that it both will take mm-hmm. time, so, and then I sometimes try to understand too, what their understanding of what medication is going to do. So I usually try to have that discussion off the bat, like, what do they expect to mm-hmm. see?
I think that's a really good point too, because like a lot of times, and the other part that my clients that take medication will come and tell me is, I don't know if this is working. And again, my answer is, I don't know either. I can tell certain things in therapy, just more, advocating for yourself and, increased self-esteem, all those things. But how, like if person A was coming with depression and the medication mm-hmm. is already past the 6 to 8 week mark, what would be the markers or like for any medication, mm-hmm. I guess a broader question, how do you know if it's working?
I usually ask like, well, what, especially with the kids, like I ask parents, what was their baseline before things were not going well? What is their usual self? Or with adults, asking someone they live with, when they, or even the person themselves, when you remember, for depression, not feeling as sad. When's the last time you remember feeling yourself, really?
Right.
And kind of go that way. And then sometimes, sometimes it's harder for kids to explain or describe things. Like, so I'll look at, their functioning in school. Like some kids are, might deal with school avoidance, school refusal, or grades might go down. So you're kind of saying, well, are their grades improving? Are they able to get their work done, the way they're supposed to, turning things in? At home, do you observe them to be engaging with the family, like not maybe staying in the room all the time or just, you know, in different aspects of their life, you know, those are sometimes some indications that, you know, things are going well. Sometimes, you know, some issues affect your sleep, your appetite. So you're also, that's why I think, you know, psychiatrists will screen, you know, those parts. So are you sleeping mm-hmm. better? You know, are you eating better? You know, any changes in weight, you know, weight gain or weight loss. So things like that is typically what you look for.
So what,
Well, that's good to know. Absolutely. Yeah.
So what would be some of the most like frequently asked questions that you've gotten on psychiatry when you're places and people say, ask you what you do and you're like, oh, I'm a psychiatrist. What are some of those questions that you get asked about your yeah. job?
Yeah. Well, usually people say, oh,
you're do you like that?
I'm like, no, you know, I don't. Okay. I don't really understand what that
means. I don't either.
Like, I don't really use that term.
Yeah, I don't understand that.
I don't know what we're shrinking. We're not shrinking your brain.
I would hope.
Wow, that would have been a really good skill. Did you learn that in the Caribbean? You know, like, I don't know. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah. No, I do get, you know, some people really don't understand what we do. And I think it's because there is a stigma about mental health. I think it's definitely improved over the years, but there's still that stigma out there. But I think the main question is, oh, you just push pills. Like you're just giving medication.
That's rude. I just say to somebody.
I have gotten that. And, you know, obviously, I'm very polite, you know, when I answer, I'm like, yeah. And to me, I'm like, you just really don't understand what our role is. And a lot of time, our role really isn't, you know, I try to be conservative with medication. So it's really listening to the patient, to their families of what is going on. And, you know, are there other ways other than medication that may help somebody? You know, sometimes there can be and sometimes there can't, you know, sometimes people come to you seeking medication off the bat because, like you said before, you know, they think that's going to be the quick fix. And sometimes it's not, you know, like we need to try other things first. And I would say a lot of times families are, you know, open to that and having to do that. But yeah, and, you know, some will do therapy still, not just you say you need to take this medication.
Which is good because I know we had a viewer question that had come in and it was about if I come to see you and I don't want to take medications, would you force them on me? So I think it's good to kind of answer their question in that it doesn't seem like that you're not a pill pusher.
Yeah. No. Ultimately it's up to you, you know, is what I would say, even for, you know, the young adults, it's up to you if you want to take it. I can tell them if I think it's warranted, you know, well, these are the medicines, these are possible side effects. It's at the end of the day, they have to decide to do it. Same for the parents as well. You know, sometimes parents come in and they really don't want to use medicine, but their other doctor thinks it would be helpful. So we just have a talk of what that would look like, you know. And, you know, if you do start medication, I always say it doesn't mean it's forever. I think at some point you should always have a trial off medication. Typically, you know, I think the rule of thumb is, even as an adult, you may try to not take medication maybe 3 times, but if every time your symptoms come back and it's affecting, you know, your functioning, then it probably means you need to restart it. And at that point, you may need to take it longer term.
I really like that you said that because I feel like that is an issue that I come over and over again in my private practice with my clients that want to get off medication, usually the younger clients, you know, just feeling like you know, maybe my medication interferes with my social life. Like I want to have alcoholic drinks or something and I can't because of my medication, or maybe like I forget to, and feeling like it's like a forever and, you know, kind of being handcuffed to it. But I think that's a really great point to bring up is, you know, taking that break, you know, maybe monitored by a psychiatrist or psychologist, you know, who's going to be talking to them and seeing, you know, if there is a change.
Yeah, I usually will recommend, you should recommend taking the medication a minimum of a year from when things started to improve. So not when you first started.
Oh, I like
when you started to see an improvement. And granted, you know, that's not a hard and fast rule. So I definitely get, you know, kids that, you know, they want to come off it because they feel better. And sometimes it's, you know, I try to counsel, well, you might feel better because of the medication, but sometimes they need to see that. Yeah. So we might, you know, instead of stopping a medicine abruptly, I definitely would do a taper. So you try a lower dose. Are things stable? Do things stay the same? However, sometimes, let's say you come off medicine, it can take up to 6 months for symptoms to return. So it's just really being aware of that and, you know, being aware of your body. And if that's happening, then, you know, making sure you can contact your psychiatrist to know what the next step, like, do you need to restart it?
So, I really like that, you know, too. I really think it's important that you just said that, because I think, you know, now, us as, you know, human beings, we want to know when's this going to happen?
Right.
When's this going to end? Like kind of like the pandemic. When are we going to... going to go back to normal? And so, but even with ourselves with medication, like, when are we going to go back to normal? Like, if I get off, but you're absolutely right. You know, you need to have improving symptoms and then see what's happening.
I think there are so many people who see an improvement in symptoms and they're doing great. And so they think like, oh, I don't need to be on the medication anymore. Mm-hmm. They get off the medication. And those first couple months after they're off the medication, they're like, see, I'm doing great. I still feel great. And then for them to know that it could be 6 months later, things can shift and change.
Right.
And that it's really kind of, in part, you know, the medication may have been helping alleviate some of those symptoms, not to then feel like they're taking all of these steps backwards at that point, that this is kind of the course of what happens when you do go off medication.
Yeah. And we'll usually talk about it, you know, if we're doing a trial off medicine, what to watch out for, what can parents watch out for, what can, you know, the patients themselves see. You know, at the end of the day, I always say it's really about, if we use medicine, improving the quality of your life. You know, I don't want to change someone's personality. That's not the purpose of medicine. Mm-hmm. You know, some people say, oh, well, they're like a zombie or they're too quiet. And really that could be, it's a side effect. So like maybe the dose is too much and you just need to lower it, or maybe it's just not the right medicine for them. So it's not meant to change who you are.
So I guess just to follow up, what is, you know, other than, you know, being a shrink, what is the biggest misunderstood thing in psychiatry that you think, you know, that, you know, other than, you know, rude people calling
well,
shrinks?
I feel mean. Like every time I hear that word, I think of, there's that scene in like Beetlejuice where the head gets shrunken. And
oh my gosh, yes,
every time
yes.
somebody says shrink, that's what I think. I like think of their head shrinking.
That is hilarious. That's, you know what though? I'll be on a total side note. I think a shrunken head thing is like part of like Ecuadorian, that's my background, Ecuadorian like myths of people in certain tribal communities that have the ability, like they collect shrunken heads, I think. That's totally like another topic for another day, but those are the true head shrinkers. Let me just say, like, that's the only ones that are really shrinking heads is these people, but we'll talk about that later. But anyways, okay. So what is the biggest misunderstanding?
Probably the other myth too is that they don't think we're doctors.
What?
Even fellow doctors, I think, don't understand with psychiatry, you actually do have to go to med school.
Oh my goodness. And I can't believe that.
So part of the reason that, we get that a lot. We get that a lot. So they're like, there's a distinction between a physician and a psychiatrist, but we really are a physician, but just a different specialty.
Wow. I mean, there's a pecking order. Like, this is high school. That's not fair. Well, then where are we, Jen? Jen, we're at the bottom of the. We're not even in the conversation. You know, we're like super pretend.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, yeah, some people don't understand like the school, the training that you have to go through.
But that makes sense, though, right? Because like you just have to. How are you going to prescribe this medication without knowing how it's going to work? You know, or like this, like your body. Yeah. Like even you talking about neurotransmitters, receptors. You understand which medications would work or not on certain,
and knowing
but
even having to know that there are certain medical conditions that display with psychiatric symptoms. And so being it
like thyroid,
having to be able to understand those differences.
And I think too, knowing there are, you know, if you have a certain medical condition, there are some medicines you probably shouldn't use, you know, that are not appropriate for somebody because of a risk of a certain side effect. So that's important to know as well.
So what do you think that somebody, like, if just, you know, what would you wish somebody knew about your work? Like, just, you know, if we could just magically put this in everyone's brain before they came to see you, what do you wish they knew about your work or medications or about anything really in psychiatry?
You know, probably that we don't have the magic pill or don't have a magic wand. And that, you know, I think it takes time to see improvement, you know, and that's so frustrating because we definitely get a lot of phone calls and, you know, something may not be working, but you really have to give it time. And it's hard because, you know, families, you know, depending on the situation, you know, feel that they're in crisis. But there are, you know, my other role too is to determine if, you know, medications are not helping or not enough, that there are other levels of care that can help somebody, you know, during a time of crisis too. You know, when I talk about that, it's like, you know, talking about different programs, like day programs mm-hmm. we have or inpatient programs that sometimes might be necessary to do.
So just a higher level than just visiting in the office, something where there's being seen more.
So we're always assessing like safety, you know, regardless of what you're coming in for, I'm always assessing, you know, safety, you know, seeing someone as outpatient, is that enough right now? Or do we need to do something more to help somebody?
And if you did, you were meeting with somebody and there was a concern for safety, what would be some of those next steps for them that you would take?
Mm-hmm. You know, well, it really depends on what they're presenting with. If families feel they are able to monitor safety at home. So sometimes, you know, there's a level of program called the day program where you go into the program, you get intensive therapy, they look at medication, but you get to go during the day, mm-hmm. but you come home at night.
And just so to interrupt you, is hospital, yeah. right? So you're talking about being at...
It's a form of a hospital. Okay. Yeah, it's a higher level of care. So it's a different... I usually say a day program is an in-between doing outpatient and inpatient.
Got it.
Sometimes we are looking at inpatient hospitalization if someone truly cannot keep themselves safe at home, you know, or just their functioning, you know, prevents them from keeping themselves safe as well. So sometimes it's having that discussion and having to look down that route. But typically, you know, depending on what's going on, we tell families that, you know, to go to the emergency room or to call 911 if something's happening, and they get evaluated there, and then the recommendation is made for the appropriate level of care.
Mm-hmm. That's good to know. I think it's really important to know, you know, what is the, what's the path, you know, especially it sounds like mm-hmm. with some parents that are coming in, or, you know, they've maybe got an evaluate or a recommendation from their primary care or from a school, and they're like, well, what do we do next? And mm-hmm. what's a crisis look like? And having, at least it sounds like you have a plan, you know, of this is what a crisis looks like versus this is not a crisis.
Right.
You know?
'Cause I could imagine in that moment, it has to be so scary to not like being in crisis and not kind of know what those next steps were. Mm-hmm. So it's good that you can kind of explain that to the families, to the patient, to be able to make sure that they do end up getting the care that they need.
Yeah. And a lot of times they come to me, you know, I might see someone the first visit where they are in crisis and they need a higher mm-hmm. level of care first, mm-hmm. you know, which is scary when you're first talking to a psychiatrist, but, you know, they don't know what's out there. They don't know the options. And, you know, I really talk about what happens in places like that. It's nothing what you see on TV, especially the inpatient units, you know, it's not those crazy stories. And a lot of times, you know, they feel more, you know, more confident about going that route, especially for their mm-hmm. family members.
Well, Jamie, we have some viewer questions, if you don't mind answering them. We were sent some questions via our Instagram site or account. I don't even know what they're called. What are they called? Jen, account, site, whatever. Page. I'm 100 years old. Okay. So, so one of the questions that we got asked, and actually this is a really good question, and I have a piggyback. I always have a piggyback question. Okay. So the question is, can I get addicted to these medications? And my piggyback question is, I've had clients that have had difficulties getting off anxiety medication, like anxiolytic medication. So I know it's a broad question from the viewer, but mm-hmm. then can you also answer my question too?
Yeah. I would say in general, I should talk about the anxiolytic separately, but in general, like antidepressants, medications for ADHD, you don't become addicted to them. Sometimes you can grow a tolerance to them where you might need like a higher dose, but it's because, you know, you're getting residual symptoms. To come off some medications, you know, sometimes the taper has to be slow. It really depends on how much you're on and for how long you've been on something. So somebody might need to slowly come off medication. And as you do, you might have, you know, it's not really withdrawal of side effects. It's just that's, like for certain medications, you could get like a flu-like syndrome. But it doesn't last. It doesn't last, you know. As far as, so like, I think I know what you're saying with the anxiolytics. So there's a certain class of medicines that people use. They're more bridging medications. Like,
yep.
I think we call them benzodiazepines. Some of those, yeah, you could, you know, I think you can develop a dependence to them. Because those, you know, they're bridging medicines, which means they provide immediate relief, but they don't last. So, you know, you feel a relief right away, but it's only going to last a certain amount of hours. But, you know, again, because I think it provides that immediate relief, that's what people tend to want to, you know, some people obviously like that.
Yeah. What it gives them. That's exactly it. You know, it was, you know, I've had so many clients, and I'd say to me in the past 5 years, saying that they've been prescribed that, or and maybe it was supposed to be used as needed, or what they've told me is PRN, right? That's the script or whatever. And then they're using it more than they need, you know, what I mean? Or like, you know what I mean? Like, you know, so I'm talking about the Valiums of the world, the Xanaxes, the Ativans, you know, and I've always thought of them as to have as like a just in case emergency, like a life jacket, like, you know, something you'd see, like, you know, like if something's really bad, you know, pop one, you know what I mean? But so I wonder if there's been a shift or a change or something that you've seen, especially with that class, I think has been, I've seen more of it.
I think so. Yeah. Yes, I'm not, you know, I think it happens more working with adults. And I feel like maybe that's part of the reason why I probably strayed away from working with adults is just because, I mean, it's the way that medicine works. So, you know, there is an indication in kids and teens, you know, they are FDA approved to use for severe panic, but I always, it's not my go-to. And it really shouldn't be your go-to because, like I said, it's a Band-Aid. So, you know, if I have kids and teens on it, I really, you know, sometimes it's needed because the anxiety is so bad, but we should always try to not take them, you know, down the line. So I look for, it's a little easier with the, you know, younger crowd. The parents can monitor it and manage it. You know, I think with the adults, it's a little harder because you want that relief because it feels so awful, you know, which is why you should also still be like, I wouldn't just rely on those medicines to manage anxiety. I think you have to at least be doing therapy too.
That's for sure. One of those, I think anxiety, it's like the gold standard. I mean, Jen, what do you think about CBT has always been the gold standard for anxiety and talk therapy, really.
Right. And a lot of, sometimes depending on the anxiety, even looking at some exposure therapy to kind of help manage and realize that we're going to feel anxious. Like, you're going to have anxiety.
It's actually good to feel, we're supposed to be anxious. It's part of our brain.
Right. Our goal is not to get rid of it, but how do you then manage, how do you manage it in a way that's tolerable for you? And not kind of sometimes relying on the medication to just get you through that moment.
I don't want to discount, you know, the use of the benzodiazepines. Obviously, if you're using it appropriately and using it as prescribed and checking in, there is a role for them because they do.
Absolutely. I think I know I've talked to people who, you know, kind of when they're feeling that panic attack coming on and they're still not at the point that they're able to use their coping skills, you know, sometimes that medication can really help to not put them through that, you know, to not have to go through that panic attack where, you know, some of them have ended up in the emergency department feeling like they're having a heart attack because of the panic attack. And so the medication can really be helpful in that sense for them. But
I usually say if you are needing to use a bridging medication, you know, more often or regularly, sometimes it is scheduled. It could mean, you know, taking a look at your longer acting medicine for your anxiety. So a lot of times we use the antidepressants to manage anxiety. And so it's maybe, you know, ideally you should also be on a medication like that to help. But it could be an indication, well, maybe that dose isn't working or maybe that medicine isn't working. You need to look at something else, you know? So we often use the bridging medicines while we're giving the longer acting medicines time to build up.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Absolutely. And kind of talking a little bit about anxiety, what do you think about the use of medical marijuana for anxiety or even for other mental health conditions? I think it's something that I would say more so in recent years has become more of a common idea or possibility for treatment of anxiety.
Yeah. You know, for me, working with kids and teens, I don't advocate for it. Partly for their age group, you know, medical marijuana is not FDA approved to use for any psychiatric disorder. And, you know, their brains are still developing. So there are side effects to, you know, marijuana use. You know, sometimes long-term chronically, it can actually, you know, worse. I think in the moment, it can help them maybe feel calmer, but there are long-term side effects to using marijuana. I know for adults, though, it is FDA approved to use.
Oh, is that the only disorder? It's supposed to be used? Okay. So, all right.
As far as I'm aware of, yeah, interesting. I would have to double check that. But as far as because I don't work with adults, I'm not, not too keen on that. But I think it is just PTSD. I think for kids, it's, there is indication to use for severe.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
Or, severe seizures. Yeah. But, you know, my rule for the kids, I just, you know, they always try to convince me, you know, why it's a great thing.
Just the kids, you know, Jamie. I think that's the adults 21? That are convincing me. Like, I need my medical marijuana card. And, you know, to each his own, you know, when you're an adult. But can I just really quickly ask about, you just brought up a really important point, the developing brain. Yeah. And so one of the things, and please correct me if I'm wrong, I've told a lot of adults, well, kids that I've seen at late adolescents, you know, why not to use certain, you know, illicit drugs, you know, because of the developing brain. When does our brain stop developing? Like, is there a time?
Oh, gosh. Even, you know, I think it's even through being a young
adult. I thought
it
was 25, 26.
So honestly, I believe it's, so even through the teenage years, that's why I do counsel teens, you know, to really, I know they don't always listen to me, but to really abstain from the illicit drugs, even marijuana, even, you know, even, I know nowadays,
but that's terrible for your respiratory system, right?
But yeah, no, right. Your brain is still developing. I mean, you know, with, I'm getting off track maybe, but with marijuana, you know, it can lead to psychosis, or if someone is predisposed to maybe a psychotic disorder.
I'm glad you said that though. You know, I really, because I feel like the biggest problem is that me as a provider have seen is that people are like, well, I use this daily because it's natural. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, are you growing this like in your backyard? I didn't know, because, you know, I really don't know the legalities about it. I know that it's, I'm thinking, isn't it legal in Chicago? Yeah. Because I'm smelling it everywhere. So, I mean, I'm assuming it's, you know, okay. And, but I feel like there is this misconception that because it is legal or whatnot, it doesn't have a long lasting side effect. Or like you said, if you don't know your family history, how would you know that you don't have, you know, you don't have psychosis in your family or whatnot?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. And, you know, I have encountered, unfortunately, you know, some patients where maybe it's not medical marijuana, but they're getting it illicitly, where it's not pure marijuana, you know, that you don't really, we don't really know what's in it. And then they have a reaction to that. Sometimes long lasting reactions or side effects, sometimes, you know, it will go away, but definitely leading to serious psychiatric, you know, symptoms that they might actually have to be in the hospital for. So altogether,
I think that's just scary.
And, you know, even as a young adult, it is. Yeah, it is. So, I usually say no.
You and Nancy Reagan just say no.
So to kind of continue.
And then as a psychiatrist though, you do have to have a certain certification though to be able to or license to prescribe it. So not every psychiatrist is going. Not every psychiatrist can write you a script.
That is good to know. I think that's. I mean, I feel like that's a question that does come up sometimes in. And not knowing, you know, now knowing that it is a specific psychiatrist who is kind of credentialed to be able to prescribe that is good to know. So kind of to piggyback on like some alternative treatments for psychiatric illnesses, is ECT still used? And is it something that is effective? Ooh. Kind of what, it was one of our viewer questions asking
about
it.
Good question. So what is ECT? Maybe we back it up because maybe the viewer knew what that was, and we're all like, "Ooh!" Yeah. but what about everyone else?
So it stands for electroconvulsive therapy. So it is like giving a shock to your brain. So it is used, it is actually safe to use, but we actually reserve it for treatment resistant disorders. So like depression or bipolar disorder that have not responded to, they've been on multiple medication, a combination of medicines. They've gone through, various levels of care like hospitalizations, and their symptoms are just so impacting their functioning. Their functioning, at home or at work, or the inability to that. We still do it. Again, that also is a specialty that you need to have certification for. I had experience with it in training. Everybody does. You kind of go through that. It's not what was in the movie, so it's actually very, I don't want to say boring, but you just, to deliver the shock treatments, you just press a button on a machine. But it is done in a medical setting, so there's a psychiatrist there, an anesthesiologist, and a nurse. Your vital signs are being monitored. They monitor soon after. Typically, it's a certain number of sessions that you have to receive. And some people actually receive what we call maintenance
What is that
PT.
about?
So it's two, they might, and I, you know, I'm, it's not my specialty. So I believe after their first round of ECT treatment, they may go, I don't know, either once a week or once every 2, 3 weeks, because it provides significant relief for them. And I have seen it work. Once in a while, we might do it for an adolescent in certain cases, not very common. Not FDA recommended, but sometimes we need to go that route because we've exhausted everything else. But typically, more so used
And this
in the
might sound like a
adult
dumb question, but
population.
because you have an I can't speak today, anesthesiologist present. That's a hard one. By the way, that's a hard word to say. And what's the one that's a nurse that helps the anesthesiologist? Thank you. You said it because I can't. Okay,
The anesthetist.
I can't say these words. I don't know why
I
they make
know.
them
I've
so
had to learn
difficult.
that.
Anyways, but so I'm wondering, that person being present, is there then something to help if it's painful? Because I mean, would people wonder, like, shock to the brain? Is this painful? It's, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, they do. They give like medications partly to calm them down. Sometimes it help, I believe, with like limb move or abnormal movements. But they do give pain medication even after they will give a patient something. And then typically if it's your first time with ECT, you are in a hospital setting, so they can monitor you like in a psychiatric unit, and they would monitor if you have any sometimes you can have short-term memory issues in the beginning, or back pain, headaches, that type of pain, but it typically does
I know
resolve.
that's a good
I know,
question.
having worked in the hospital system for a long time, have seen the long-term effects of somebody who's had ECT use and the positive changes that they've reported in themselves after having the treatment, and how for like I've had I remember one person saying she felt like it gave her life back after she went through it, because she had been on so many different medications in and out of the hospital, really like trying exhausting all avenues before trying it, and then feeling like she was a different person for the better, like she was who she was before.
I mean, isn't that what you were saying too before? Like you, like
It
the
does
purpose
work.
of medication is to of life improvement, and that sounds like it. So, Jamie, is there anything else that you would like to share with us or our audience about your work, medications, anything, words that we can't pronounce? What anything at all that comes to mind before we wrap up today?
It's okay to seek help, I think for mental health issues, for emotional issues, and to just know that off the bat, we're not just going to say you need to take this pill. And I think it's also important to know there has to also, just like with a therapist, there has to be a good connection. It might take a couple of visits to really be able to open up and share something, obviously, with your psychiatrist, and that might be.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for all your time. I know we've taken up a lot of your time with our questions and and getting off
topic.
Oh, no,
this was so much fun.
And if anyone, you know, just, and this is just to the audience, if anyone has any questions too, we can also send them to Jamie. You'll feel free to send us a message to our Instagram account, which is at therapy_podcast_. Is that right, John?
Did I get
it right? Okay. So just send it to us, DM us there, and then we will send a message along and then post it. Mm-hmm. But for now, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you guys for having me.
We enjoy having you on with us.
All right. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you guys.
Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed this podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us wherever you listen to good podcasts, and keep up with episode updates on Instagram. Follow us at therapy_podcast_. You can send us messages on topics you'd like to hear or anything that comes to mind. Bye for now.